My name's Richard Dennis, Chief Economist at the Australia Institute, and you're listening to a special Christmas edition of The Lucky Country, a podcast brought to you by Schwartz Media, the publisher of The Monthly, The Saturday Paper, and Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund, Future Super. The Saturday Paper's my source of quality long-form journalism every weekend, and The Monthly's the country's best magazine of politics, culture and ideas. They even publish some of mine from time to time. This week we'll be looking at the questions we've got from listeners over the course of the year, and helping me in the studio today is my colleague Matt Grudnoff. Matt, welcome to The Lucky Country.
Thanks for having me.
Before I start with the specific questions that you've sent in, let me set the scene a little bit. A lot of the questions I've got over the year relate to what's good for the economy. Is marriage equality good for the economy? Are tax cuts for big business really good for the economy? Is population growth really good for the economy? We'll turn to those questions and a few others throughout the podcast. But before we turn to those, what does good for the economy really mean? Let me start with a ridiculous recent example. The New South Wales Premier, Gladys Berejiklian, is currently proposing to knock down stadiums and build new ones in order to help the economy. Now, things get old and need to be knocked down from time to time, but anyone that's been to these stadiums think they might be a little bit out of date, but they're perfectly functional and could certainly simply cope with a refurbishment. But in order to grow the economy, in order to help the construction sector, and indeed in order to help the tourism and sports part of the economy, we've been told that spending $2 billion demolishing stadiums and building new ones is a good idea because it's good for the economy. How can we as citizens consider this question? Well, from an economist's point of view, we start with a concept called opportunity cost. That is, what else could we do? What other opportunities do we have? The question for New South Wales government, the question for New South Wales taxpayers, indeed the question for all of us is, all the things we could do with $2 billion, which things are the best? Now, we can't all agree on what the most important priorities are. That's where democracy kicks in. But we still need to have a conversation about what are the benefits of going in different directions. $2 billion spent on new stadiums to replace the old ones is $2 billion that wasn't spent on new schools, on new hospitals, on new transport infrastructure, on renewable energy, or indeed on tax cuts. So how can we as a society answer these questions? The simple answer is it's hard, and the honest answer is economists don't really know. What we can do is help people understand the options, the alternatives, and we can help spell out what some of the consequences, some of the benefits might be. But when it comes to what's good for the economy, ultimately that's a democratic question. In some countries, Northern Europe, for example, they think it's good for the economy to collect relatively high levels of tax and spend a fair bit of money on health and education. In America, they think that collecting a lot less tax and spending far less on public health and public education is good for the economy. Different people in different countries make different decisions. There's no one answer to the question, is something good for the economy or not? But that doesn't mean we shouldn't have rigorous and well-informed debate about what the options are, what the alternatives are, and what the consequences are. So in today's podcast, we'll answer a few of your questions about what might or might not be good for the economy, but keep in mind there's no right answer, but there are better and worse ways of having these conversations. So, to our questions. We've had a number of questions about whether marriage equality is good for the economy or not. There's been a lot of talk about the impact on bakers and the impact on wedding planners. Matt, what do you think? Is marriage equality going to be a big boost to the economy?
Probably not. And the main reason is that opportunity cost says that if you spend more on weddings, if you decide to get married and you're spending more on a wedding, then you're spending less on other things. So while the wedding planners and the cake bakers and the venue hirers might do particularly well out of this, local cafes where you're no longer going because you're saving up for the wedding, those kind of entertainment things, going to the movies, other discretionary spending, you're likely to cut those back because, damn it, you're saving for that wedding and it's an important day and you want that money for the wedding, but it means you're not spending the money on other stuff.
So you're saying that marriage equality really will reshape the economy, but perhaps won't grow it that much.
Exactly right. And, I mean, if you're crazy enough, or perhaps not crazy enough, I shouldn't say that, if you want to go into debt for the wedding, then it might give an initial sugar hit to the economy because we're bringing forward some spending. But again, you're going to have to pay that money back off in the long run.
What, you've got to pay loans back?
Well, apparently, yes. You know, it could have an initial sugar hit. And as you say, it'll reshape the economy. There'll be different parts of the economy that will do better, and there are other parts of the economy that will do worse.
I agree entirely, but so much of our public debate seems to conflate good for one part of the economy with good for the economy. And I guess an obvious one, another one we've had questions about, is Christmas good for the economy? Now, I'm no Christmas Grinch, but by your logic, Matt, you're saying Christmas doesn't really boost the economy. What a heresy.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, if we all decided that we weren't going to buy Christmas presents this year, well, you know, then what would happen is we would just spend more money at other parts of the year. So all of those having to find a car park at the mall at this time of year, having to get out and do stuff, that would vanish because there wouldn't be heaps of people in the shops. But what it would mean is that you'd be spending more throughout the year. So rather than concentrating it in one point, it would be spread out for the rest of the year. There are advantages to us all getting together and celebrating something, don't get me wrong, but as far as just an economist, you know, a heartless, soulless people like you and me.
The dismal science.
The dismal science. If you're just looking at the economy and nothing else, then no, it doesn't really help the economy.
But what if we borrow lots of money to buy the Christmas presents that people don't want?
And we get bill shock in January and we all have to go to the hospital after heart attacks, yeah. Look, again, there's an initial hit. So there's no doubt that if you borrow more money now, then more money is spent and there's a hit to the economy. There's an advantage to the economy. But that money has to be repaid at some point. The credit card bill will come due. And when it does, you're going to be going, well, I'm not going out to the movies this month. I'm not going out to the cafe. I'm not going out to a restaurant because I've got to pay the bloody credit card bill because I bought that fantastic thing that the kids played with once and then threw away.
But it was a good day.
It was. It was a good day.
Hopefully.
And those prawns, they cost a bloody fortune, and now they're cheap.
What better time of year to eat prawns than the time that everyone else has eaten prawns?
Absolutely.
Now, the chief executives and chairman of the big four banks have written to us asking the government to step in, end the uncertainty and ensure an orderly process that addresses the concerns. Cabinet has met this morning and has determined that the only way we can give all Australians a greater degree of assurance about the financial system is through a Royal Commission into misconduct into the financial services industry.
There's now going to be a Royal Commission on banking. The government was kind of pushed into it. Is this going to be good for the economy in that the banks are going to clean up their act? Or is it going to be bad for the economy in that it's going to create uncertainty in the market? The banks won't like us, so they'll charge even more interest. They have so much power. Basically, is a banking Royal Commission good or bad?
Ah, so the whole good for the economy really is in the eye of the beholder, isn't it?
Definitely.
Yeah, so the Bankers Association have been adamant that first there was no problem, second that there were plenty of problems, but the existing regulatory structures were coping well with them. Finally, they agreed that, yes, we should have a Royal Commission, but not just into the banks, into everybody. Make it big,
yep,
make it broad.
Make it enormous and make it short.
Which, if you think about it, is fascinating because they've been arguing that, you know, a Royal Commission will create uncertainty in the finance sector, yet the version of the Royal Commission they support is the broadest possible Royal Commission you could have. They've brought in the insurance industry, they've brought in the superannuation industry. So,
but I thought they were concerned about uncertainty.
Well, this is my point. It's as if they think, well, if we have to suffer uncertainty, so should the entire finance sector, which makes me suspicious that perhaps they don't really mean it. And I really don't. I think a Royal Commission will have a trivial impact on the economy in the short term. Again, it'll be good for the lawyer industry and probably good for the cafe industries near the courts. But the issue is, in the long run, what will it do for our economy? Now, we force Australians every month to put 9% of their income into superannuation. You can't avoid the finance sector in Australia. It's compulsory. It's compulsory to buy financial products. And in order to buy a home in Australia, a mortgage is effectively obligatory. Very few people would ever inherit or save enough money. So if you have a job, you have to be involved in the finance sector. And if you want a house, you effectively need to be involved in the finance sector.
And also, if you want to get paid, you need a bank account. There are very few employers that put your pay in an envelope and hand it out at the end of the week.
Indeed. We've made it an essential service. And of course, the same is true for welfare. Even if you're unemployed, you have to have a bank account because the government won't hand you cash. So we've created this enormous, incredibly profitable, the world's most profitable banking system. And there are no doubt all sorts of problems and scandals that have been uncovered. But big picture, the question is it well managed? Is it well governed? Are the regulatory structures fit for purpose? And if they're not, a Royal Commission will help us find that out and we can do something about it. And if at the end of a Royal Commission, in a shock finding, it turns out that everything's tickety-boo and there's really no problems there, then given the enormity and the importance of the finance sector in the Australian economy, getting a clean bill of health is hardly going to be problematic. So it's going to be expensive. And the banks are saying, look, we're going to have to spend all this money on lawyers and we're going to have to pass that on to you, the customers. Well, those same banks spend far more on advertising. In fact, their advertising often says, bank with us, we're cheap, when, of course, every ad they run makes their product dearer. So, yes, there's going to be costs to the bank shareholders, costs in time for the executives. A lot of lawyers are going to work on this. But in a $2 trillion economy, keeping the finance sector well governed and well regulated in the long run is far more important than the lawyers' bills for the banks today.
We risk Australian businesses and Australian wages because we can become stranded on an uncompetitive tax island if we fail to respond and act accordingly.
So we've also had questions on the corporate tax cut. So the government's talking about giving $60 billion away to business. They want to force it through Parliament. So is that going to be good for the economy? Is that going to be jobs and growth? Jobs and growth. We hear about jobs and growth. Is the corporate tax cut going to improve jobs and growth?
Well, according to the people who are going to receive the tax cut, it's a clear yes.
What a surprise.
Well, you know, if economics knows anything, it's that we assume people make decisions based on their own self-interest. So it's good to see that the leaders of Australia's largest businesses are acting completely in their self-interest and, of course, in the interest of their shareholders. So, yeah, the idea that cutting company tax rates is a good way to help the economy, it's good for the economy, is not a new one. In fact, it's been around for many years. If you've ever seen Ferris Bueller's Day Off, there's a great scene in there about voodoo economics, the idea that cutting taxes is such a good idea that it will grow the economy so much that the new, bigger, low-tax economy will pay more tax than the old, smaller, high-tax economy.
Free money, Richard. Free money.
Free money, free beer tomorrow. This is not a new idea, and it was once called voodoo economics by that well-known lefty George Bush Sr. He actually mocked the idea. And then it's evolved into lots of other terminology, including trickle-down economics, that if we give big tax cuts to those at the top, whether it's the biggest businesses or the highest income earners, that we will stimulate all this activity in the economy, that firms will invest more, that rich people will buy more things they don't need, and that the benefits of that will trickle down to us.
It's amazing how much public policy these days involves us trusting that the rich and powerful should get something now and that the rest of us will get something later. Isn't that just amazing?
But it's only to help us, Matt.
It is ultimately, they are only doing it for us. If we give them a tax cut, if we give them stuff now, it ultimately will benefit us.
I mean, a bit of a distraction here, but the number of people that seem to have gone into mining purely to help Indigenous people in Australia.
Amazing.
I mean, heartbreaking.
It is.
Heartbreaking. But, you know, let's face it, a wonderful sentiment. It's a pity they haven't haven't helped many Indigenous people yet, but...
But it will happen any day if we just make them just a little bit more profitable, if we can just repatriate those profits overseas just a little bit more,
scrap
it will happen.
Scrap the mining tax, yep. You name it. So yeah, this argument has been around for a long time. I think we'll be arguing about it in 50 years' time. I don't want to suggest that anyone has ever landed the definitive answer. But what we do know around the world is that there are high-tax countries, high-tax, high-wage countries like Sweden, Norway, Denmark, that have thriving manufacturing export industries. Anyone that's ever seen a Volvo knows that Sweden does export things. Anyone that's ever seen a Nokia phone, well, once upon a time at least, but it wasn't changes in tax rates that led to the demise of Nokia. Anyone that's ever shopped at IKEA knows that there are vibrant and very profitable export businesses from these high-tax countries. And we also know that there are low-tax countries that have vibrant, booming economies as well. The issue is tax the main determinant of what's going on? And there's very little data to suggest that. I've already quoted the well-known lefty George Bush Sr., but the well-known progressive institution, the International Monetary Fund, has gone out of its way in the last couple of years to say that not only is inequality a brake on economic growth, but that the tax system is an important way to reduce that inequality. So we're being told by some in Australia that if we cut the corporate tax rate, it'll be great for business and it'll be great for us. We've tried it before, didn't work last time. Other countries have tried it, often doesn't work. But what we really do know is that people that are pushing for this have the most to gain from it. And I think it's understandable why people might be a bit sceptical about that.
And where does most of the tax cut go? Does it mostly go to these small businesses, the mum and dad operations, the local news agency down the street, or does it go to larger businesses?
We've already cut the corporate tax rate for small and medium-sized businesses. The tax cuts that are still on the table are purely for the biggest businesses. And interestingly, there's data out just this week from the Australian Tax Office making clear that most of these big businesses don't pay anything like the 30% statutory tax rate. Indeed, you have enormous companies like Exxon not actually paying any company tax in Australia at all. So for all of the talk of the need to cut taxes, it seems that many of these businesses seem to have solved the problem themselves. Now, Matt, we've had a number of questions about unemployment. There's a lot of confusion about what unemployment is and how it's measured and indeed what we can do about it. But let's break that down. When we hear that someone's unemployed in Australia, and I think you used to work at the Australian Bureau of Statistics, didn't you?
I did indeed.
Not in the labour force section, was it?
No, not in that section.
Can you just explain briefly what unemployment means to someone working at the Australian Bureau of Statistics measuring unemployment?
Well, what it definitely doesn't mean is somebody on unemployment benefits. The unemployment rate has nothing to do with the number of people who are on unemployment benefits. To be unemployed in this country, you have to not have a job, you have to be actively looking for a job, and you have to be willing to start that job in the next week.
So whether I'm on the dole or not doesn't come into it from the Australian Bureau of Statistics point of view.
No, absolutely. So you might have some horrible job where you only work 1 or 2 hours a week. That would make you employed. So if you work 1 hour a week, you are employed as far as the Australian Bureau of Statistics goes. But because the unemployment benefits are means tested, if you're only earning $20, $40 a week, then you're still going to be on unemployment benefits. Also, ABS is very interested in whether or not you're actively looking for a job. If you're not actively looking for a job, as far as the ABS is concerned, then you're not in the labour force. You don't count as unemployed. Whereas for the unemployment benefits, there is a test. You do have to go out and look for jobs, but you might not really be after a job. You might be quite happy to be on the unemployment benefits, and so therefore you'd still be getting them, but you wouldn't count as unemployed.
So let me get this right. If I work for 2 hours a week, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, I'm employed. And if I'm employed, by definition, I can't be unemployed.
That's exactly right. Yep.
But if I work 2 hours a week and the ABS says I'm employed, Centrelink will still be willing to give me income support because if I meet other criteria, but the fact that I work 2 hours a week, earn $40 a week, doesn't prevent me from being eligible for unemployment benefits, even though the Australian Bureau of Statistics says I'm not unemployed.
That's exactly right. So the Australian Bureau of Statistics has a very strict criteria for what unemployment is. And quite often, if you were to take the number of people who were on Centrelink payments or unemployment benefits and divide it by the total population, you would probably get a larger percentage of people that was unemployed than was officially unemployed.
So let me get this right. I'm working 2 hours a week. I wish I was working 40 hours a week. I'm officially employed, but I don't have nearly enough work. Surely the people at the Australian Bureau of Statistics understand that working 2 hours a week isn't enough for most people.
Well, there's a couple of things to that. The first is when they originally came up with these definitions of unemployment, this was back in the 50s and 60s, where if you're employed, chances are you were A, male, and be employed full-time. The idea of part-time casual employment was, there was far less of it. So if you were working 1 hour, chances are you were working full-time. So they didn't really worry about trying to come up with a definition of employment that was based on how many hours you worked, whether, you know, 15 hours is enough or whether 40 hours was enough. The other thing is the ABS is also interested in what they call underutilization. That is people who want to work more. So if you're working 2 hours a week and you'd rather a full-time job, then the ABS does have measures of that underutilization. That is, they say, well, you're under what they call underemployed. You want a full-time job, but you only have a part-time job. Or you have, you know, a very casual job where you might have hours 1 week and not the next, but you actually after a more permanent part-time job.
So the ABS has data on underemployment, and the ABS has data on people in precarious work, casual work and short-term work. When governments talk about creating jobs, what are they talking about?
Well, I think when the Treasurer and the Prime Minister talk about jobs and growth, people hear jobs in the 1950s, 60s sense of the word. They think about a full-time, stable job that's reliable into the future. Unfortunately, our economy is creating more and more precarious jobs, that is casual jobs, part-time jobs, gig jobs where, you know, you might be an app might pop up and say you've got some work today, but tomorrow you won't. All these kind of jobs that aren't stable. Basically, the way I think about it is if you went to the bank and decided you wanted a home loan, the bank is going to look at a lot of this income and go, no, I don't want to lend you. It's not stable. It's not steady. I'm not willing to lend to you. Whereas when people think of jobs, they think of the kind of income that the bank would go, yeah, actually, I want to lend to you for a mortgage. And when people don't have this secure jobs, it creates other problems. So what we have is this disconnect between what politicians are saying, they're talking about we're offering you jobs, and what the public think jobs are, that is full-time stable jobs, and there's that disconnect between the two.
So when they say we're creating jobs and growth, it sounds more like they're creating precarious jobs and low wage growth.
Yeah, absolutely. There's and that's the other thing in the economy. You've hit the nail on the head. Employment might look quite nice at the moment. The unemployment rate officially is reasonably low by historical standards, but there's been no wages growth, and people are feeling that. And if you look at the retail figures out of the ABS, that is how much people are spending in shops, is completely flat. That is, that hasn't grown at all
times. We had a number of questions from people saying, why did we cut penalty rates? Is it true that cutting penalty rates will create jobs, or will cutting penalty rates actually, you know, harm the economy? Coming back to what it means to be good and bad for the economy, but what's the argument for cutting penalty rates?
Well, the argument is that if you cut penalty rates, then the wages bill of the firm will be lower and therefore they will hire more people. Now, if you just think about that only for a second, it doesn't make sense, because what we're assuming behind that is that firms actually hire people because they like to, that it's a generous thing, that it's an altruistic thing. Firms hire workers so that they make stuff, they make goods and services. The amount of stuff the firm sells is what's going to determine how many people they employ. If the amount of stuff they sell goes up, they'll employ more people. If it goes down, they'll employ less people. And if they're selling the same amount of stuff, they'll employ the same number of people. So if you cut penalty rates, that doesn't change how much stuff the firm is going to sell.
Well, hang on. Like, so when I go to the shops and I see bananas are really cheap, I like bananas, and I think, oh, I might buy a lot of bananas because they're cheap. Are you saying that's not how firms decide how many people to employ?
That's exactly right. They don't look and think, well, there's lots of spare people on, there's lots of cheap people on the labour market. I'm going to throw in a whole heap of people and just have them hang around and sweep floors or look pretty in the shop.
Have you told Scott Morrison this?
Well, perhaps somebody needs to. I would have hoped that his department treasury would have been telling him this, but apparently not. So, you know, I mean, at best, cutting penalty rates will do nothing to the economy. At worst, it will actually shrink the economy. Why? Because if you cut most people who get penalty rates are low-income earners who usually spend the vast majority, if not all, of their income. And so if you cut their wages, you're cutting demand out of the economy. The people who are gaining out of this are obviously the owners of businesses. If you're selling the same amount of stuff at the same price, but now you have to pay less for your labour, your profit's gone up, so you're better off. The problem is the owners of business usually aren't very low-income people. They don't usually spend 100% of their income. So effectively what we're doing here is reducing the amount of demand in the economy, which could reduce the amount of employment.
Hang on. Aren't retail sales figures quite flat at the moment?
Yes, and, you know, to be honest...
could these things be linked?
They could well be linked, and it'll be really, really interesting. I mean, this next quarter is actually the largest quarter because we have Christmas and we decide to ram all of our spending into one quarter, or we like to spend more. And if they're flat in this quarter, that could be quite concerning.
So, cutting company taxes, cutting people's wages and avoiding royal commissions into the banks, one way to help the economy, according to the Business Council of Australia. We've had a few questions from people saying, so what can we do? What if we want to grow the economy, create jobs and growth, what are good policy solutions? So if you don't think cutting wages and cutting taxes is it, what could we do differently if we wanted to?
Well, I mean, there are all kinds of things we can do. It depends on, as a society, and this is a democratic question, but as a society, what do we want more of and what do we want less of? Do people want more health and education? Do they want better transport systems? Do we want more time with our family? Sometimes it's not all economics. Perhaps sometimes what we actually desire is more time and to spend in relationship with people. So really what the question of good and bad is it's not so much an economic question as a societal question, as a democratic question. And as a society, we need to sit down and think, well, what do we want more of?
Wow. I know someone that wrote a book about that recently. So in a shameless plug...
It's Christmas time too,
isn't it? It's Christmas time. What better gift than to purchase a copy of Curing Affluenza by yours truly. But no, I mean, Matt, it's a really important point you made. These are democratic questions. So much of our debate about what's good for the economy, we turn to economists to ask that. And of course, a lot of economists work for the banks that don't want a royal commission or work for the businesses that would like to pay lower wages. But when we look around the world, we see all different shapes and kinds of economies, some with big health and education sectors, some with very small health and education sectors, some with great public transport, some with none. Which one's the right one?
Yeah, and I suppose what's more dangerous or what's most concerning is that when economic arguments are used to say you can't have that stuff. So we need to have to cut penalty rates, we need to cut corporate tax rates, but you can't have health and education because they're quote-unquote unsustainable. And now what unsustainable means is I don't think it should be a priority. So when you hear a politician say the age pension is unsustainable, our health spending is unsustainable, what they're saying is I don't think we should prioritise the age pension and health spending. I think we should be prioritising spending on ships, submarines and...
Corporate tax cuts,
exactly right. And so when you're thinking about what do we want, one of the biggest problems or the biggest concerns and how we use economics is that it limits the choices that we have. That you know, we can't have what we actually want. We have to have this other thing because it's good for the economy.
Kind of like when I tell my kids that they can't have their dessert until they've eaten their vegetables.
Exactly right. You're effectively limiting their choices.
Well, and I'm linking their choices. They have to do what I want them to do before they can do what they want to do.
Yep, exactly right. And so what we need to do is we need to see through these arguments. We need to see them for what they actually are, a bunch of politicians who are deciding what we can and can't have. And because they know they just can't tell us outright that, they need to convince us that the things that they want and the things that their donors perhaps want, they're the things that we have to have and they'll be good for us in the long run. And the things that we actually want, we can't have because they're too expensive and unsustainable.
All right, but if my kids just want to have dessert all the time and they see through the fact that they don't really have to eat their vegetables before they can eat their dessert, you know, don't we have to be responsible? Aren't there some things that we have to do? We can't all have it all. Surely there's some truth to the idea that we can't double the age pension, double the unemployment benefits and go build houses tomorrow for everyone that wants them. There must be some constraints here.
Absolutely there are constraints. I mean, we're a rich country. We can have whatever we like, but we can't have everything we want. We can't have everything on the menu, but the idea that there are some choices on the menu that are being taken out, that are being taken off the menu, and there are others that are put in that we're told that we have to have. That's my concern. Now, absolutely, we can't have everything we want, but we should have an honest debate about the things that are there, and we should have a democratic debate about what we actually want as a society.
Sounds like I need to ask my kids whether they want vegetables or dessert for dinner.
I'm pretty certain, knowing your kids, that what the answer will be.
Growth through the year averaged 4.5%, which exceeded the forecast.
The economy grew by a solid 0.5%.
GDP grew by 0.8%.
We are growing faster than every economy in the G7.
Yes, we're about to beat the Netherlands for the longest run of growth without a recession, but we've been helped by the fact that we take more migrants from the rest of the world than much of the rich world does.
I actually believe in a big Australia. I make no apology for that.
And moving forward means moving forward with plans to build a sustainable Australia, not a big Australia.
One last question that's come up a number of times over the course of the series relates to population. Is population growth really good for the economy? Do we need to have population growth? And relatedly, some people have asked, are refugees, is bringing in more asylum seekers good for the economy? Leaving aside now what good for the economy means, where does population and immigration fit into these big debates?
We measure the economy as the growth in gross domestic product, GDP.
So that's the total amount of stuff that we make.
That's exactly right. Everything that's made in the economy, that's GDP. Population growth actually makes GDP rise faster. If you have a bigger population, then obviously more stuff is being made and more stuff is being bought, and so GDP goes up. So what population does is it increases GDP faster than it otherwise would. But of course, there's another measure that the ABS also puts out that people don't look at all, and certainly the politicians don't, and that's GDP per capita.
So that's GDP per person.
Yeah, how much stuff each person made on average. Now, population isn't going to change that. That is, if we bring in a whole lot of people, then sure, GDP goes up, but also the population's gone up, so the amount per person has not changed.
Right. So whether population drives GDP growth or not is actually pretty irrelevant. A more important question would be, would having a larger population make us all better off? and that would be measured as GDP per person.
That's exactly right. And GDP per person doesn't look nearly as large as far as growth rates go, obviously, as GDP. And so you can see why politicians, when the GDP figures come out, though lately they haven't been particularly great, but they tend to look at those headline rates rather than GDP per person.
Yeah. I mean, the way I often think about it is a country like China with 1.3 billion people has very large GDP. But its GDP per person is much smaller than Australia's. So China's GDP, China's gross domestic product, the amount of stuff they make in China dwarfs the amount of stuff made in Australia. But when you divide their GDP by their population and you divide our GDP by population, GDP per person in Australia is much higher. Now, there are small countries like some of the Pacific Island nations that are quite small, have small GDP and low GDP per person. Mm. But then you've got places like Monaco, which have very small GDP, but GDP per person is very high, some of the richest people in the world. So, yeah, we have this whole debate about what does it do for GDP, but really it's GDP per person that gives us some insight into what living standards might be like in a country. That brings us to the end of this special episode of The Lucky Country. I hope I answered the questions that you sent in, and if we didn't get to them this time, maybe we'll get to them next year. The Lucky Country will be back on air next year, and we'll keep you updated about dates. I hope you have a Merry Christmas. I hope you have a great summer. I hope you spend money on things you like. I hope you don't waste money on things you don't like. But all up, I hope you cook up some good plans for your life over summer, and next year I hope you act on them. The Lucky Country is a Schwartz Media production brought to you by Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund, Future Super. Thanks for all your emails. Thanks for all your support. The show's produced by Andy Hazel. I'm Richard Dennis. Thanks for listening.